Welcome to the Coin Podcast Network.
A family of five takes a Sunday drive and vanishes.
Well, has anybody seen or heard anything today? Try and get any kind of information. Nothing was going on.
One detective refusing to accept the official story.
It's much, much harder to substantiate accident theory than it is the foul play theory.
More than six decades later, the mystery endures, and the question remains.
This kind of thing just really didn't happen. It was always a mystery.
What happened to the Martin family?
When we find the car in the Columbia River, we will find the Martin family, and we will solve this case.
Hello, I'm Ian Costello, and welcome to this special presentation from the Coin Podcast Network. 62 years after a Portland family vanished in the Columbia River Gorge, Coin 6 News anchor Jeff Gianola and I sat down with author J.B. Fisher to talk about the case. Over the course of 9 months and several conversations with Fisher and others, Jeff and I put together this story on the Martin family, the strange circumstances surrounding their disappearance, and the mystery that remains. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy. Back here in the Coin Podcast Network studios with Coin 6 News anchor Jeff Gianola. Jeff, part one of this podcast, Into the Water, ended with the discovery of a bloody and battered gun. And now you're about to tell us how Detective Graven made a startling discovery when he traces that weapon.
Yeah, it's really surprising, Ian, and it adds a whole new piece of intrigue to this mystery.
The Martins disappeared in the Columbia River Gorge. Jeff, let's catch some people up on some of the things we discovered in part one. And it's really the geography of that area that is important to this story.
Well, location and time are the key to any investigation. So let me paint a simple picture of the geography. You have the mighty Columbia River flowing down the gorge, and along the river, the town of Cascade Locks. 19 miles east of that, the town of Hood River. Then, Ian, about 22 miles east of that, the town of the Dalles. And as you heard in part one, when and where the Martins are spotted that Sunday is in conflict. Eyewitness reports and evidence back up Detective Graven's theory that the Martins met with foul play, their car and bodies pushed into the river at the Dalles.
Yet the official story is that they accidentally backed into the river in Cascade Locks, which is 40 miles back toward Portland from that location.
Yeah, and that was based on the fact that they know Ken Martin purchased gas at Cascade Locks, but there was never any hard evidence that they drove into the river there. They continued to cling to that accident theory without any hard evidence, ignoring new clues and evidence that Detective Graven was uncovering. Ian, you and I talked about this. We said this really is not just a story about the missing family, but a story about the determination of a dedicated detective to solve this mystery on his own, knowing he was close to getting answers even though no one was listening to him.
And Detective Graven is about to uncover another clue that comes along with the discovery of the bloody and battered gun. And with that, let's begin part two.
Part two, two girls and a gun.
Thank you. 1959.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot for the sake of old anxiety?
It was the beginning of a new year. Christmas had come and gone. It had now been 40 days since the Martin family had vanished. Without any hard proof or evidence, investigators were clinging to a theory that the family had somehow accidentally driven into the Columbia River at Cascade Locks. But one detective, working on his own, had already determined the family had most likely met with foul play in a different location. Detective Walter Graven had never met Theodore Hellyer, but fate was about to step in, and their paths were about to cross. On January 18th, Mr. Hellyer was out walking not far from Cascade Locks when he spotted something in the brush under a rock. He knew immediately what he had found: a .38 caliber gun.
The gun has one shell casing jammed in the barrel, and the butt is damaged with blood and other kinds of material on it.
J.B. Fisher is a true crime writer. His book on the Martin family mystery is called Echo of Distant Water. J.B., it's not only the condition of the weapon, but where it's found that's important.
The area where the gun was found was not very far from where the ex-cons had abandoned the car. And that's the same ex-cons that had been seen with the Martin family over at that Hood River Cafe the very day that they disappeared.
Mr. Hellyer turned the gun into the Hood River Sheriff, and there it sat. It was never analyzed for evidence, never processed. The sheriff had already determined that the Martins accidentally drove their car into the river. In his mind, the bloody gun had nothing to do with their disappearance, and J.B., he never notified anyone about the gun, including Detective Graven?
Jeff, it's actually really quite puzzling. There was no effort to investigate the gun.
After a few weeks, the gun was given back to Mr. Hellyer, exactly as it had been found. Bonnie Cox was the widow of Theodore Hellyer. In a 1986 interview, she described the gun's condition.
And then it was completely coated with the dried blood from whatever they clubbed. They had clubbed something to death, apparently. Covered with the dried blood all up and down the barrel. It was dried. After they decided, you know, it had been used to kill something.
Detective Graven was never told about the bloody battered gun. But when he did finally find out about the discovery, he was furious.
My grandfather was extremely upset. It was almost 2 months that firearm had been discovered and returned, and he did not have any clue that that even took place for 2 months.
Greg Graven is the chief of police in Yamhill, Oregon, and Detective Walter Graven was his grandfather.
There are protocols that are required to take place even back then regarding the finding of a firearm, and those protocols were not met. The firearm being run to check if it's stolen, the firearm being processed if there's something of contaminant that's suspicious on it. And none of that took place.
And JB, it wasn't just the gun. There was other possible evidence found nearby.
Yeah, there was a bonfire that Detective Graven describes in one of his reports. And he talks about how the remains of this bonfire was very near where the gun had been found. And he tried to get the Hood River Sheriff to investigate, but maybe unsurprisingly, he was unsuccessful.
As Detective Graven begins to investigate the stolen gun, he uncovers perhaps the most bizarre, stunning clue in this whole story. The serial number on the bloody gun was an exact match to a gun reported as stolen from the sporting goods department of the Myron Frank department store in downtown Portland a few years earlier. It was among the unrecovered items taken by an employee at the store. And Detective Graven knew that employee was no other than the only Martin not missing. Eldest son, Don. JB, as we read Detective Graven's notebook on this case, he had been checking up on Don for a while.
Even though Don was back east, remember he was in the Navy at this point, Detective Graven had been investigating him. Graven also had talked to the manager of the Meyer and Frank department store within the first several weeks of this investigation. And at that time, remember, he had learned that this gun was one of the items that had gone missing.
Don was never arrested for that theft, but this may have been one of the reasons Don was estranged from his family.
Yeah, he was never arrested, but he had several problems with the law while he'd been working at Meyer and Frank. He worked there over a series of years, on and off. He definitely had tensions with his parents because he had gotten into trouble a couple of times and I think they were getting frustrated. The understanding is that Ken Martin, Don's father, paid for some of the stolen items.
How did the gun that Don Martin had stolen a few years ago end up near the area where his family had disappeared, bloody and battered? It seemed a staggering coincidence. Greg, as a young boy, you often heard your grandfather talk about this case, specifically Don Martin.
I would hear my grandfather talk about Donald Martin and this case. We, as law enforcement officials, have to be careful in our dialogue when we're having a conversation. So what my grandfather would say off the record would be that Donald Martin is a suspect in this case. However, on the record, he would indicate he's a person of interest.
A person of interest. It had been almost 4 months since the Martins disappeared, and Don had remained back east the entire time. He had not come out to aid in the search. JB, was Detective Graven ever in direct contact with Don Martin at this point in the investigation?
No, Graven only really learned about information on Donald Martin through the New York Police Department. And one of the things that he learned was about long-distance phone calls that Donald made to some friends right after the time of the disappearance.
So Detective Graven had been checking up on Don this whole time because he had his suspicions.
He definitely had Donald in his sights as far as suspects at that point.
Later, Detective Graven will meet Don face to face, and his thinking on Don's involvement will change. More on that encounter later, but if not Don, then who? What was their connection to the Martin family and possibly Don? And what would be a motive for killing the Martin family? Time was ticking away. Any chance at getting evidence from the gun was gone, and Detective Graven was missing two key pieces of evidence. He had no bodies, no car. His gut told him both those things could be found on the bottom of the Columbia River at the Dalles, below a rocky cliff where he had found tire tracks and paint scrapings matching the Martins' car. He was convinced this was no accident. If the Martins had driven to the Dalles on their own, it would have been dark outside, and Detective Graven knew Ken Martin didn't like driving at night. And Greg, that's a fact your grandfather couldn't ignore.
It is, Jeff. My grandfather would scratch his head wondering why, after he learned that Kenneth Martin did not like to drive after dark. He had a hard time seeing at night, and so he would not drive when it was dark out.
The mighty Columbia River is a working river. Tugs pushing barges loaded with grain move up and down the water. In May 1959, 5 months after the Martins disappeared, a drilling barge was doing some work offshore of the rocky cliff near the Dalles, the spot Detective Graven had pinpointed as the place the Martins' car went into the river.
they were setting footings for the pump station for the aluminum plant.
Dan Portwood grew up with Sue Martin. He was in her class at school, and he later would become a detective in the Dalles.
As I understand it, they'd set anchor upstream so that they would be relatively permanently fixed downstream. And the anchor didn't hold, so they were basically dragging anchor and fouled it on something very heavy. They started pulling in the anchor, and one of the deckhands was using a pole to reach down, and he said he hit metal. Then the thing came loose.
The deckhands on board the barge report the object felt like a car. As it came loose, it seemed to roll under the surface of the water. Then they saw what they described as two bundles of clothing float to the surface, then drift downriver. And JB, it all happened so quickly, but it soon became apparent what they had hooked.
Well, it was hard to tell at that point, but the next day, a couple of fishermen at Cascade Locks reported seeing two bodies floating through the locks and described how one of them drifted apart toward the Washington side of the river.
The fishermen's eyewitness accounts would prove to be accurate. The next day, May 3rd, the body of 10-year-old Sue Martin is discovered in the Columbia Slough near Camas, Washington, along the shore near a paper mill.
She was found among logs and debris just beyond the Crown Zellerbach paper mill in Camas.
The next morning, May 4th, the body of 12-year-old Virginia Martin is discovered in the Bonneville Dam spillway on the Oregon side of the river.
An operator of a gantry crane working on the dam spotted the body. And at that point, the public braced itself for the discovery of the other three family members. It was assumed that they'd be found imminently, but that never happened.
Had the anchor on the barge hooked the Martin's car, somehow dislodging the bodies of Sue and Virginia before falling back down to the river bottom, trapping and entombing the bodies of Ken and his wife, along with the body of 14-year-old Barbara. Gloria Graven is Walter Graven's daughter. As a little girl, she remembers her father talking about this case.
Dad assumed that Kenneth Martin was shot in the head, and the girls and the mom then probably knocked out, and the car shoved over into the river. It's really deep where this particular spot is.
Could the bodies of Sue and Virginia Martin provide the clues to prove Detective Graven's theory? Russell Bissett was a deputy sheriff who aided in the autopsy of the girls. He took pictures of Virginia and Sue's bodies. And JB, he saw something that bothered him.
Yeah, interestingly, in 1999, he told Oregonian reporter Margie Belay the following. He said, "Both girls had holes in their skulls, identical holes above and behind their right ears. I thought they were from either a gunshot or a blow."
Russell Bissett had assisted in hundreds of autopsies, but when he pointed out what he saw to the medical examiner...
Medical examiner determined that they both died from drowning and that there was no sign of foul play. Normal decomposition and even the suggestion that any kind of imperfection like a hole might just be part of that decomposition.
That conclusion bothered Russell Bissett the rest of his life, and it didn't settle well with Detective Graven, who had seen hundreds of autopsy photos in his career. He knew what homicidal trauma to a human body looked like. And Greg, you remember your grandfather specifically talking about this with your father.
I do remember him talking with my father about that and his frustrations. Again, my grandfather had been a detective and a dedicated detective for many years. And he had investigated numerous homicides. And he knew and had an eye for suspicious injury as a result of some type of violence not accidental.
Suspicious injury, not accidental. It didn't matter. The medical examiner had the final word. The discovery of the bodies pushed the sheriff of Hood River to search the Cascade Locks location once again with divers. Nothing was found, yet he persisted in his claim. The Martins accidentally drove into the river at the locks. That's where their journey ended. Case closed. Meanwhile, 40 miles upstream, Detective Graven put together a team of divers to search the water at the Dalles, the place he was convinced the Martins' car went into the water.
This is a really treacherous section of the river. It's narrow, it's very deep, in some sections 70 to 160 feet deep. There are huge boulders all over on the river floor, swift currents. During the dives, we do have notes saying that Walter Graven was threatened by Oregon State Police to basically stop searching in that area.
And around the same time as the unsuccessful dive search, Detective Graven hears a story from someone who operated the drilling barge that hooked the heavy object.
He learned from one of the barge operators that one of the two ex-cons linked to the abandoned car tried to sell him a .38 caliber gun with a damaged butt.
It matched the description of the bloody and battered gun found near Cascade Locks, the gun Don Martin had stolen years earlier. And JB, Detective Graven had been looking into those two ex-cons.
Just a few weeks earlier, he had searched the Hamilton Motel in the Dalles, where one of the two ex-cons was staying. And an interesting thing about that motel is it's just a few hundred yards from where the tire tracks were discovered leading off the cliff.
Coincidence versus hard proof. When you're a detective, you need facts. No matter what Detective Graven uncovered, he was told to wrap things up, stop your investigating. And JB, this was true when it came to the ex-cons?
Some of the newspaper coverage in the days and weeks after the story broke involved this idea that those two ex-cons were being investigated, that they'd been apprehended and were being pursued. But in fact, that didn't happen. And we learned from other material that as of December 10th, no one knew where they went. No one bothered to investigate them.
Detective Graven wanted to find and question the ex-cons, but he was facing increasing pressure to stop his investigation. When he expressed his concerns to his superiors, they made it very clear what they thought of his work.
Late spring 1959, Graven has a meeting with one of his supervisors who literally took one of Graven's reports, lit it on fire, and dropped it in a metal wastebasket. Now, if this isn't a strong message, I don't know what it is.
On June 1st, 1959, 6 months after his family disappeared, Don Martin came back to Portland from the East Coast. And JB, he met with Detective Graven face to face.
Well, the two met for several days. There are actually a couple of really interesting photographs of that meeting. And during the time, Graven started to really shift his focus away from Don as a suspect.
Detective Graven specifically asked Don about the stolen gun.
One of the things in Detective Graven's notebook is marked June 1st and 3rd, Donald Martin. And it actually quotes Donald Martin here talking about the gun. It says, New York police told me about the gun being found. I have no knowledge of it. Wayne had a buddy who worked in sporting goods. Wayne liked guns. I didn't. I just like nice things.
Wayne. Detective Graven knew Wayne had been Don's roommate several years ago when that gun was stolen from the downtown Portland department store. JB, do we know if Wayne had been in touch with Don when Don moved back east?
We did learn that Wayne, in fact, kept in touch with Don once Don had moved back east.
Did Detective Graven interview Wayne?
We did learn that they did, in fact, speak at some point, although there are no details of any specific interview in any of Detective Graven's notebooks, so we don't know what they specifically talked about.
Dawn had another reason to come back to Portland other than being questioned by Detective Graven. He came to settle the family estate.
Well, it's interesting, the estate switched at some point during the search from Charlotte Dorsey, Ken's sister, to Dawn. But it's also really important to point out that this was a very modest family. They didn't have a lot of money.
With Dawn's visit and the settling of the Martin estate, it was becoming apparent that time was running out for Detective Graven to form clues and coincidences into solid, hard evidence. In a last desperate attempt to convince his superiors not to abandon the investigation, he writes a confidential memo. And JB, what does that memo say?
I want it understood that I am not now or at any time trying to make a murder out of an accident or vice versa. I'm just trying to do the best job that I am capable of, as you who are my superior officers should expect me to do. And then he goes on to basically talk about what he calls the coincidences. And he says, here are the coincidences for your information. Use them or disregard them as you see fit. And he goes into all these different elements that we've been talking about. The gun, the cliff site, abandoned car,
the ex-cons. And his superiors disregard everything Detective Graven had uncovered. And his official one-man investigation comes to a halt. Greg, you told me your grandfather was devastated by this, and this case haunted him the rest of his life.
From his notebook, but from personal experience, me as a young child listening to my grandfather and my father talk about their experiences, the cases, the stories that they would share, there was always a time when my grandfather would stop, and I would hear this of his fingers on the table. And that was my cue as a young kid to go sit around the corner on the floor because I knew what conversation was coming. It would be about the disappearance of the Martin family. My grandfather would say, when we find the car in the Columbia River, in the Dalles, we will find the Martin family and we will solve this case.
In October of 1959, 10 months after the Martins disappeared, a memorial service was held for the Martin family. And JB, what do we know about that service?
It was held at Rose City Methodist Church, where the family had been very active. But for some reason, Dawn wasn't there.
No one knows why Dawn didn't attend the memorial service for his family. We do know the cremated remains of his sisters, Virginia and Sue, sat on the shelf of a mortuary for the next 10 years. In 1969, Ken Martin's mother died. Someone then had the girls' ashes buried with their grandmother. Later that year, their grandfather's remains were interred in the same plot at Rose City Cemetery. Weeks turned into months, months turned into years. And it seems over time, most everyone had come to accept the family's disappearance as an unexplained tragic accident. But not Detective Walter Graven. He hadn't been able to solve his case, but he had a strong feeling he couldn't shake. Whoever harmed the Martins knew the family or had a connection to them. And JB, he felt the Martins had not left their home that Sunday morning for a simple Sunday drive. He felt they were on their way to meet somebody.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot that comes down from Detective Graven's own notes and papers, and also he passed on to his descendants, the idea that this was some kind of a rendezvous, that they were going out there to meet with someone.
Things get overlooked in investigations, miscommunication, or something that didn't seem that important at the time. 6 months after the Martins went missing, a neighbor called police wondering if they had followed up on what she saw, the Monday morning after the Martins disappeared. Hours before anyone knew the Martins were even missing, a neighbor saw a taxi idling in front of the Martins' home. The driver looked like he was waiting for someone inside.
So a neighbor from a few houses up the street who claimed that she always left for work at the same time Ken Martin did, noticed at the same time Monday morning a black cab idling in front of the Martin house, and she actually had to ask the driver to move because he was blocking the street. And she couldn't get through, so she asked him to move, and when he did, she noticed he was kind of slumped down in the seat as if just kind of waiting for someone. She says she first saw the cab at about 7 a.m. and noticed it was still there at about 7:30, so the cab was waiting there for a while.
And if there was someone inside the Martin home, it appeared they were looking for something.
Interestingly, down in Ken's basement office, someone had gone through papers on the desk and several pages of ledger book and other materials were missing.
Just when you think things couldn't take another turn, Jeff, here we've got a taxi outside the Martin home, and based on some of the pieces Detective Graven eventually put together, there's probably somebody inside the Martin home rifling through Ken Martin's ledger book and other files. When all five of the Martins who live in that home, Ken, Barbara, and the three girls, are supposedly dead in the Columbia River, isn't it strange that someone is at their house?
Yeah, early the next morning before anyone even knew the Martins were missing.
I guess that is just another one of the hurdles popping up in Detective Graven's path here. Not only has he been told to stop investigating by his superiors, this investigation has been stymied since the beginning by a total lack of communication between law enforcement agencies. We've got two huge examples of that. The bloody and battered gun that we heard about at the end of part one. And now, at the end of part two, here we've got this witness report that someone is in the Martin home mere hours after they have vanished.
Yeah, Detective Graven's daughter, Gloria, who we'll be hearing from, told me her father ran into obstacle at every twist and turn, and she pointed specifically to a captain that he had to report to who seemed to create a lot of the problems for the detective. She also told me in those days there was an awful lot of jealousy and rivalry among police agencies.
You're left to wonder what would happen today if the Martins had gone missing this week instead of this week 62 years ago.
Well, you have incredible cooperation now between police agencies, better technology, GPS tracking, and of course, more media coverage. You know, Ian, in the 1950s, newspaper and radio were the two main sources of news. And that's how the neighbors of the Martins and their friends followed this story and the whole city on radio reports and newspaper reports. The local TV news really was still in its infancy.
And Jeff, once again, we see how this has become a story not just about a missing family, but the dedication of Detective Walter Graven. He just keeps moving forward, not buying the official account that this was a tragic accident.
Yeah, and the clock is ticking. Can he put all his clues and circumstances together to solve this case before his time runs out?
Jeff, we'll talk to you again before part three.
The Coin Podcast Network is here.
Top of the morning to you.
Hundreds of episodes featuring exclusive original storytelling.
There's one story that haunts me.
Thousands of listeners seeking out on-demand content.
Considering how politicized our society is now, I think people consider it a much bigger deal.
Tens of thousands of downloads and counting.
Do we need to mentally prepare ourselves to be hit with both the flu and coronavirus at the same time?
And one great opportunity to partner with the Coin Podcast Network. Be part of our groundbreaking mission. to provide our listeners with in-depth reporting on news.
Firefighters are really barely able to keep their breath.
Weather.
Portland metro area and the valley do get some snow.
Sports.
Welcome to another episode of Beaver Smack.
And entertainment.
She was the first person to say, you're going to be an author.
Coverage that no other local media outlet is bringing to Portland. Welcome to the Coin Podcast Network.